Let my people go. I have plans for them. What a fitting text for us. We're about to be let go. And we need to be rest assured in the truth that God has plans for us. To those verses in the opening portion of the book of Exodus, that great story of God's deliverance, I want to draw your attention this morning. The purpose of God's refining of us is to cast a character, ours, to be like His. Here's a story I came across some time ago. In a small municipality in one of our Rocky Mountain states, a group of women had been meeting as friends for Bible study for quite some time. In the course of a study at the end of the Old Testament, they came across this text from the book of Malachi, which described God as a refiner and purifier of silver. That part of the country, silver smithing and silver making is fairly popular, and one of the participants in the Bible study said, "I happen to know a professional silversmith. Let me, if I could, this week go and watch him work and see if from his task any insight can be drawn as to what Malachi might have been getting at as he reflected God's word in chapter 3 of his book." She didn't tell the silversmith the reason for the request, but she did contact him that week and went and watched him as he was taking rough silver, newly mined, and to begin the refining process to turn it into something else. She watched him carefully take a chunk of silver and place it in a holder as close to the fire and in its midst as possible. His comments to her were that silver needs to be held in the hottest portion of the fire, that the impurities could quickly be burnt away. She, is watching him, couldn't help but think of one illustration right away in her mind, how God often holds us to the spot where the fire is hottest so that the impurities can be purified and burned away. And couldn't wait to get back to reflect to her Bible study group that thought. She asked the silversmith if it was necessary for him to actually stand there and hold it and watch this whole process, why he couldn't simply put it in a holder and walk away to another part of the shop and go to some other task. He carefully told her that that was impossible because if the silver was held even a few moments longer than was necessary, he ran the risk of ruining the entire metal and making it unable to be used for anything else. The woman was silent for a while and then asked again, "Well, how do you know when the silver is completely refined and is ready to be drawn out of the fire?" To which he said to her with a smile on his face, "Well, when I can see my reflection or my image in the silver, then I know it is completed." "In the fires of affliction," someone said, "child of the Most High, remember that His eye is on you, to see His image in your life." That's a truth for us to grasp, and it's a truth that certainly played out in this most famous story of God's rescuing of His people. The place of God's rescue is a kingdom conquered, and it is interesting to think back to the nation of Egypt in which Israel had found herself. To the average person, given the fame that Egypt has drawn, especially in recent decades and generations when so many of the discoveries of archaeologists have brought the world and the life and the nation of ancient Egypt so vividly to our imagination, a place of massive pyramids, of beautiful and ornate temples, of beautifully colored hieroglyphic inscriptions, mummies, strange-looking human forms on great monuments, it is truly an attraction for even the most casual observer of ancient history. The wide distribution in magazines and in traveling displays in museums, even here in the Chicago area, have gripped a lot of us for quite a long time. To us, Egypt is a fascinating, mysterious, majestic, beautiful place. But to the Israelites, it was something very different. Leon Wood said this, "The land of ancient Egypt brings to most people's minds a sense of mystery, sense of magic, a sense of magnificent structures. To the ancient Israelite, however, the situation was quite different. For him, Egypt meant slavery and humiliation, but at the same time, a great victory and the birth of his nation. This is the place where God's people were found captive. The book of Exodus truly is a necessary sequel to the book of Genesis and should never be read apart from the books that surround it, from Genesis all the way through the book of Deuteronomy. After God chose Abraham to begin his work, to give to that man a special promise of a land, a people, and a seed, everything that follows after it is a fleshing out, a living out, a carrying out of God's promise to Abraham. The last chapter of the book of Genesis ends on a rather sad note. It says that Joseph, at that time the great leader and statesman, an Israelite himself, of course, was placed in a coffin in Egypt. Many questions in the reader's mind would instantly come to the forefront. If God made promises, then we seem now to see the last of the patriarchs now dead, gone, and buried. The book of Exodus begins with Egypt with Israel in a coffin in Egypt as well, because they are enslaved and no freedom is theirs. The tragedy of human suffering and slavery makes that great Exodus a memorable event on a historical basis, to say nothing of its truthfulness in the Scriptures. It is an exciting story of freedom, and when we unpacked this series several years ago, we saw a good part of that. The book begins, rather surprisingly for a modern reader, as is so often the case in the Old Testament, instantly we're met with a list of names. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household. To us, it's a difficult beginning. Doesn't seem to fit a good literary style. We have to then struggle with the ancient names, none of whom were around at the time in which this book was penned. But to a people beginning to have a national identity forged, to especially young people who were just now beginning to learn a little bit of their own history, to a multi-ethnic gathering of people, refugees and slaves, now about to be molded into a nation, it was important to remember their history. From whence have we come? Who are we? And what are we about? And the situation here describes a circumstance in which you are there for a purpose. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. The situation that drove that patriarch to that land is an interesting and a familiar one. He was, of course, a favorite in the family. The sons of Israel, in order to come out of Egypt, had to get there in the first place. And what was it that drove them there? Well, the family favorite, almost the youngest of the brothers, was jailed there, sent there by his own very jealous brothers who had had a tense relationship with him for quite some time. He played upon his father's clear favoritism of him and finally got to the point where the brothers could no longer tolerate him and sold him as a slave, assuming they would never lay eyes on him again. God had other plans. Joseph, as you well know in the book of Genesis, goes from a slave to an assistant to someone with responsibility to a teller of dreams and a relayer of truth, and is elevated to the second highest place in the most mighty empire in the world, and finds himself now a tremendous leader there. His brothers are driven to him not by choice but by circumstance. A famine existed in the land. They were starving. They were at risk of losing everything. But in Egypt, there was food. Why? Because of the wise providence of Joseph, a man sent ahead of them to prepare to save God's people. A favorite in the family, a famine in the land. That's what got the people there. Joseph in a position of leadership, his brothers in a position of need. You look carefully at the history of this group of people, and one needs to marvel at the grace and mercy of God. This was not a collection of heroes of ethics and morals and accomplishment. Indeed, their lives, as you find them played out in the Scriptures, except for Joseph and his rise to authority, is filled with sin, murder, debauchery, and adultery. They were not accomplished people at all, certainly were no better than the Egyptians were in a lot of what they had done. They were there because of God's mercy and goodness to them, not because of any remarkable history on their part. This Dirty Dozen had scattered throughout the Bible a long history of broken promises and very questionable ethical behavior. A sordid tale of violence and philandering and all sorts of other matters. Like father, like son, Jacob's own life was scattered with deception and theft and lying, and his sons were sinners all. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died. If sins defined this people, then this was a people who had been rescued by a Savior who kept his promises. What is great about the nation of Israel is not the nation of Israel, but the God of the nation of Israel. A God who had laid his claim upon these people first through Abraham, and then through Abraham's son Isaac, and then through Isaac's son Jacob, a God who affirmed his covenant commitment over and over again to several generations, and who said, "I will keep my word to you." And even though the brothers intended Joseph's situation to be for evil, Joseph was able to see in his wisdom, you might have intended it that way, but God meant it for good. God was a promise-keeping God who affirmed all the truth that he was to be. The Lord was Moses to write later, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands, and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. What a gracious, wonderful, good God. A God who affirmed truthfully his promises. Then Israel came to Egypt, said the psalmist. Jacob sojourned or lived in the land of Ham, and the Lord made his people very fruitful and made them stronger than their foes. They were neither forgotten nor abandoned, but rather strengthened and flourished. What made these sons of Israel so powerful again was not their lives, but their God. Not what they had done, but in whom they believed. Not how their character played out, but the God who called them for his purposes. I will confirm my covenant to you and will greatly bless you. I will confirm my covenant to you and increase your numbers. God made a promise, and a promise he was going to keep. Israel entered Egypt because of God's purposes. And in this place were God's plans about to be fashioned. God providentially used several things, the first of which was the fear of Pharaoh. Not the fear about Pharaoh, but literally Pharaoh's fears. The Bible tells us this, "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph." Now that expression doesn't mean I've never heard of Joseph, but rather Joseph's skill and Joseph's faith and Joseph's wisdom and Joseph's character I had never seen and never experienced. Oh, I read about it in some old dusty scroll that my father and grandfather made me read, but him personally I knew not of. Therefore, I have neither respect for his God or trust in his words. And he said to his people, this Pharaoh, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and are too mighty for us." Joseph was honored by the Pharaoh with whom he was first introduced, so much so that his skill at interpreting a frightening dream on the part of Pharaoh's part led to his promotion, his elevation to a significant portion in the land. Even when Joseph died, the Egyptians honored him with a state funeral. If there had been television in that day, all stations would have been focused upon that procession, honoring Joseph for the greatness of who he was. No more. A new dynasty, new perspective, new understandings, a new difference. Matters were now getting harder for the people of Israel. What fears of Pharaoh began to play themselves out? Israel went from privilege because of Joseph's skill now to persecution. How and why did this play out? Look, these Israelites have become too numerous. We need to do something about this. We have to deal with them wisely and thoroughly and completely, lest they betray us, fail to defend our borders, indeed join with an enemy, and our power is lost and our kingdom is destroyed. Like most dictators, Pharaoh was paranoid. constantly looking over his shoulder, constantly fearful of his hold on power, because he was not there by popular vote, but by power and fear and intimidation. And it was that sense of paranoia that now led him to do something. His immigrant population had now become too large. There was fear in his mind. It could now destabilize my entire government. He was so worried the next time he would be attacked that these immigrants would betray him that he began to worry. He twisted and used what is so often a temptation in our own day, to blame the situation in a country upon a particular group of people different from who we are. And that kind of racial prejudice here against an ethnic minority was showing itself out in Pharaoh's mind. These people could be dangerous because they are different, because they are not us. We need to do something. And so the fear of betrayal now drove Pharaoh. Egypt or Israel went from privilege to persecution. Egypt went from being a partner with Israel now to a perspective of prejudice and of peril. Their fears were now about to be overcome. "Come, let us deal shrewdly with them," said Dr. Douglas Stewart in his translation, "or they will increase, and in the event of war, join our enemies and fight against us and take possession of the land." And so Pharaoh had a strategy to overcome, keep in place, and keep power over the nation of Israel. He overcame Hebrew tears. "Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. The more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves. They made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and in brick and all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. They first tried oppression. Israel went from being shepherds to slaves." As is so often the case, particularly in cultures of that day, where you stood on the social ladder directly related to the power and influence you had. The lower you moved, the quieter and quieter and quieter your voice became, until you were powerless and empty. Their original identity as shepherds, as those contributors to the economy in some significant way, now was changed. They were becoming conscript construction laborers, unpaid indentured servants, the lowest of the low. Their voice was quieted because their influence was shrunk. First, oppression. Then exhaustion, cruel labor in building these cities. The cities most likely were those sitting on the eastern frontier of Egypt. If you can have in your mind a map of that part of the world, the Sinai Peninsula, which sits today between Egypt and Israel, would have been guarded on its eastern frontier by these massive cities. Pharaoh would have intended to build them not only as places to reside, but places to defend, to give a warning to potential or about potential invaders. Because of that, these cities not only needed to be built with some significance, they needed to be easily defendable, requiring walls. They needed to be supplied with food and with weapons. You can begin to get a sense of the massive construction task demanded of these laborers. Build, supply, construct. They would have been required to give perhaps even of their food locally. Pharaoh would have demanded from citizens everywhere a portion of their agricultural produce to be given to the government. And in these areas around these cities near the land of Goshen, where Israel had been for several centuries, would have demanded quite a bit. Imagine if you are an average Israelite family. Father is recruited to work long hours and long days away from the family farm. What happens? Who is going to work the fields? Who is going to tend to the livestock? Who is going to grow the crops? Families were separated for months at a time. Birth rate perhaps began to fluctuate and drop. At least this was Pharaoh's mind. I will work them as hard as I can. Their food supplies will drop. And in all reality, any system of slavery worth its salt doesn't care about unhealthy people, but works them literally to death. And if they can't stand the workload, they will undoubtedly die. I will reduce their numbers. I will deprive them as best as I can. Now, I doubt Pharaoh took on this thought with simply saying, let's kill all the Israelites, though he did start with youngest ones. How tender I feel this morning with a young grandson here in church, thinking that if he had been born in Egypt at the time of the Exodus, there would have been a target on his back and a wanted poster in the local nursery. Kill all Hebrew boys. Pharaoh didn't intend to slaughter them outright, but he constructed circumstances in such a way that their numbers will be reduced. Their influence is gone. They will either starve or work themselves to death, and so I will have my power over them. Scholar Umberto Casuto, when he was translating the book of Exodus, translated verse 14 this way. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel work with rigor. He made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field, supplying food for their families. Oh no, stores for the cities. In addition to all their other work, wherein they made them serve with rigor. Imagine putting in a 14-hour day in the blistering Egyptian sun, returning home and then needing to care for duties around the house. It simply is impossible to sustain. And one can only wonder at the sad reality of the death toll that would have been there. Little time left for family or farming. This was the strategy of Pharaoh. Under this terrific burden is where we find Israel. But we find them in a place where God's purposes, where God's preparations were finalized. His chosen were not forgotten. The oppression of these Israelites raises, of course, the question that all of us wrestle with. Why is there suffering? Why do people have to go through this? Why, especially, do God's people have to be under this kind of circumstance? And we apply situations to this text the way we do to that question every time it occurs. The levels of responsibility are several. The Egyptians were responsible for the suffering of the Israelites. They had culpability in this task. They made them slaves. They demanded of them at the threat of death that they do what we tell them to do. Build our cities. Store them from your agriculture and do not complain at the point of a sword. The Egyptians had that sense of culpability. We suffer because of the sin of others. We all sit under a sin. We all sit under the curse. There is suffering in our world because of the fall of our first parents. Because God cursed this world with death, with sickness, with suffering, so that even the world itself, to use the apostles' phrase, groans under the curse. We need not look far to find out why it is we are in difficulty. We are sinners all, and therefore we treat others with contempt and lack of respect, with evil and poor attitudes and poor intentions. We suffer because we ourselves are sinners and we live in a fallen world, with disease and disaster, debilitation, all of that, we sit under the curse. But everywhere and in every situation, God remains in control. It was His providence that rescued Israel from famine and got them into Egypt. It is His providence that is going to rescue them from Egypt and lead them back to their promised land. His chosen were meant to be forged into a community. If you think about the risk of God sending Israel to Egypt and then being quiet for 400 years, this truth is significant. God had told Abraham, your people will become a great seed, a great nation. I will give to your people a land. I will fulfill my promises to your people. But those people, 70 only, had now grown into a mighty nation. But where were they? in a foreign country. Think of the risk that might have happened. What if they had completely assimilated? Oh, maybe not the first generation. Maybe not Jacob's grandchildren. Maybe not even his great-grandchildren. But now, a generation or two into it, as they were Egyptianized, as they felt cultural pressure to step into the worship, the dress style, the culture, the values, the gods, the expression, the experience, the marriages in Egypt, this sense of a special, unique covenant community could easily have been lost. We know in the history of this nation, the pull to go back to Egypt was a powerful one. Yes, it was a place of suffering, but it was home. Yes, it was a place of slavery, but that's where I live. That's what I know. That's where I'm familiar. It is hard to move. It's hard to move. And this nation was pulled so strongly, but God intended to bring them out of that connection, and He did so by allowing their suffering. Dan McCartney, when he was thinking generally about suffering, had this insight. I thought it applied here. His chosen would now want to forsake Egypt. God saw the suffering of His people and then delivered them. But why did He allow the suffering to take place in the first place? Could He not have simply prevented it? If He had done so, would the Israelites ever have wanted to leave Egypt? It was hard enough to get them to leave even when they were suffering. It's hard enough for us to leave the treasures of this evil world even though we suffer in it. How much harder it is for us to desire the new heavens and new earth when our lives here are comfortable. Suppose God had put a protective bubble over Goshen. The weather was always great. The crops always flourished. The livestock always birthed. The families always grew. The Egyptians always were kept away. Who'd want to move? This was Eden. This is great. We're not going on. God knew that His people, if they felt that way, would never have been part of the purposes that He had. And so to uproot them, He allowed them to suffer. We find some interesting applications here in our lives. God allows suffering to step to us to form His character, just like the silversmith. I want to see my image shining and reflecting in them. If we never have trouble in our journey, why would we ever want to end it? If life on this world is so good, how could heaven be better? Except what I have now just advanced and accelerated. God allows things into our life to sort of separate us and remind us that He has better and different purposes. This is a thought to keep forefront in our mind, that God is in the process of developing us spiritually. He has higher values for us that sometimes include the provision, the allowance of difficulty and suffering, sickness, physical disability, unemployment, the reversal of our financial circumstances, false accusations, betrayals, difficulties, unjust treatment, prejudice, the loss of those things we know and love. If we know that God is always providential, then we wouldn't look upon these trials as though something highly unusual was happening to us. You remember, we live in a fallen world and interact with sinners who often have no good except their own in mind. It doesn't mean we're careless or unsympathetic to other people. Hey, you're suffering, get over it. God has a purpose for you. Not at all. The Bible tells us we weep with those who weep. We care for those who need caring for. But it does mean that instead of us just asking, why is this happening to me? We rather should ask, Lord, what is Your purpose in this suffering for me? One thing God wanted to do among His people was that they would be forged into a community and they would willingly be able to forsake Egypt, a place of suffering and difficulty. He called them to be His own. His chosen were not forgotten in this place of difficulty. He intended them to be forged and kept as a community. He wanted them to forsake Egypt for the purpose that His chosen would be forever grateful. Once we have been redeemed by the Lord, gratitude should mark our existence always. Israelites learned that lesson while they were languishing in Egypt. After they were released, they always were to remember the captivity from which they were liberated. Moses later was to write this in his last sermon, right before they entered the promised land from Deuteronomy. My father was a wandering Aramean. That's about as negative an assumption of Abraham as could be there, a wandering Aramean. He went down into Egypt with a few people and lived there and became a great nation, powerful and numerous. Through his grandson, the nation ended up there. But the Egyptians mistreated us. They made us suffer, subjecting us to harsh labor. Then we cried out to the Lord, the God of our ancestors, and the Lord heard our voice and saw our misery, our toil and oppression. So the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, with great terror and with signs and wonders. He brought us to this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Then you and the Levites and the foreigners residing among you shall rejoice in all the good things your Lord has given you and your household. Be forever grateful. 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 They were grateful because they saw from which they had been taken and how God had delivered them from that for His purposes. We oftentimes only think about Thanksgiving in November in our culture. We talk about themes for which we should be thankful. We have sharing times here in church in which we express our gratitude for our church and our community, our congregation, our country, and all the good things that God has done. But surely, this kind of joy and gratitude should mark our lives all the time. Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in His steps. That's what Peter said. For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross. Paul said, you rejoice in your sufferings because you know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance character, and character hope. There's a purpose in that suffering. God and His people could see His hand upon them in a very powerful and profound way. His chosen could always, always, always be trusting. God has some good things yet for us, Paul said there, and God illustrated in his life. When I delivered this message before, I excerpted this short story from a book entitled A View from the Zoo. I don't watch Nat Geo station very often, so my ability and exposure to wild animal understanding is limited. So I speak not as an expert, but I was so struck by the story, if it's true, and I'm assuming that it is, that it shows in a miraculous way God's care for us. Describing the birth of a giraffe, which must truly be an amazing thing to watch under any circumstances, Mr. Richmond says this: the first thing to emerge from the are the baby's front hooves and his head. A few minutes later, the plucky newborn calf falls 10 feet and lands on its back. 10 feet. You've just dropped your baby from a basketball rim all the way to the floor. Wow. Within seconds, the calf rolls upright with his legs tucked under his body. From that position, he considers the world for the first time. Shakes off the last vestiges of the birthing fluid from his eyes and ears, and then mom steps in. The mother giraffe lowers her head long enough to take a quick look. She then positions herself directly over her calf, waits for about a minute, and then does the most unreasonable thing. She swings her long, pendulous leg outward and kicks her baby so that he goes sprawling head over heels. The baby gets up. This violent process is repeated over and over again. The struggle is momentous. As the baby calf grows tired, the mother kicks it again to stimulate its efforts. Finally, the calf stands for the first time on wobbly legs, and then the mother does it again. She kicks him off his feet. Why does she do this? What cruelty could possibly motivate this? Why? She wants the calf to remember how it got up. In the wild, baby giraffes who struggle to walk or to run are easy prey for lions, leopards, wild hunting dogs, hyenas, or any other predatory animal. It is an act of love and compassion for that mother to allow her calf to suffer and therefore gain strength to be able to run with speed, keep up with the herd, and save their lives. Mom didn't hate. Mom loved. Mr. Richmond instantly saw the application to his own life. "There are many times," he said, "when it seemed that I had just stood up after a trial only to be knocked down again by the next. It was God helping me to remember how it was that I got up, urging me always to walk with Him in His shadow and under His care." Brothers and sisters, no matter what steps into our lives, what level of providential suffering our good Lord may allow, know always that your character is His highest priority. His love for you will always be expressed. His control is always evident. And His care for you is always permanent. Let's pray. Father, for this illustration in the life of your people, this great story from Exodus, we have seen your provision and care. You who forged a people in the midst of great difficulty and chose to lead them from adversity to the adventure of following you and seeing your promises fulfilled. In like manner, we too often experience suffering and deprivation, disappointment, discouragement, disease, disability, derailing of our lives. Help us always to look to your hand, knowing that we're never abandoned, never forsaken, that in all things you are working for the good of your people. We need patience under suffering. We need your care. We need a reminder of your truth. That we may always sing that your name is blessed forever, regardless of what may happen. May this truth be anchored to our minds and hearts. I pray because of Jesus. Amen.